Hi, hello, welcome to Off the Record here at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. This is the second of these chats that we have this year, something that the Actors' Centre do, and I'm Paul Clayton, the chairman of the Actors' Centre, and it's my great privilege that we get to invite actors along to talk to me about their careers. The Actors' Centre has been going in existence now for about 38 years, and we're just the other side of Covent Garden. And it's an organisation that's there to support actors at all stages of their careers, to help them develop skills, to network, and just to be with their tribe when they need to be. So if you haven't been to check us out, please do. Off the Record's a brilliant opportunity for me to get to chat to nice people who I have had the pleasure and privilege of working with. And today I'm joined by somebody who probably you're all looking at. We haven't banished him today. He comes as a bit of a job lot. I'll be talking to him and not her, and we won't be slinging any mud when I talk to the delightful person who is Russell Tovey.
Hello again. Thanks. Thanks.
I make it really simple for myself that I start all these interviews with the same question. Can you identify a moment? Can you think back to a moment that was the beginning of the journey to where you are today, that when you thought, that's what I want to do?
Yeah, there's two things. I started drama club when I was 10, 11, but I remember being on a school holiday, and before that I was doing gymnastics. And one day we had a lad who was in Grange Hill, and he was at the Silver Youngs Theatre School, and he came down and everyone had photographs next to him, he could pose next to him. And I was really starstruck by him. His name was Desmond Askew. Still got the signature at home. I don't think he's working now, bless him. But he inspired me. And I remember I had a summer holiday and I watched, I've talked about this before, but watched like four movies. I watched Dead Poets Society, Stand By Me, The Goonies and Home Alone. And I remember thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to be a runaway in New York. I want to go and find One-Eyed Willie. I want to... I was just so inspired by Robin Williams. Robin Williams became my, like, total hero. He was someone I looked up to so much, and I was so inspired to work with him. When he died, that was totally gutting to me, because he was part of the mix of my kind of coming of an actor age moment. So that, for me, was a total tragedy. But I remember then thinking, that's what I want to be an actor, and I used to pretend I had an American accent. And I remember when Lakeside Shopping Centre first opened in Essex, and I kept going up and going, excuse me, where's the restroom? And obviously, my accent wasn't as good then, and they were like, mate, it's over there. And they must have thought I was so weird. It was a weird little kid. But that was my moment, really, when I was like, that's what I want to do. So my mum sent me to a local drama club called Step by Step in Hornchurch in Essex, and it was all singing, all dancing, all acting. And I kept going, really, and went to my last year at junior school was when I first started doing all that, and kept going.
And so you then ended up with a very young Russell Brand in something called Mud.
Yeah.
Was that the first thing you did?
The very first thing was an episode of The Bill.
Oh, good. Okay,
yeah.
Thank God
I was playing a traveller. And I threw a football, I threw a football at a police officer's car and called him scum. That was quite, my parents were proud of that. Not that they're criminals, but just my performance. And then I did a kids' TV show called Mud, which was on CBBC, and did two series of that. And it was about a group of scallywag kind of commoners, which I was the leader of, called Bill Bailey. And then there was a load of poshies, and it was all the kind of a comedy, drama, kids thing, adventure thing about the poshies and the commoners, and them mixing at like a Butlins week away. And Russell Brand was in it. Russell Brand was 18. And I've actually got a signature at home, because as a kid I collected autographs. I got very kind of starstruck of everyone around me. And it says on it, to Russell, the most divine enigma on Mud, love from Russell. And I'm being 11 going, what the fuck does that mean? I don't know what that means. but that's how we always spoke. So it was never like, when you see him now and he's sort of pulling these words out of the air, some Dickensian character, that is actually his personality. And I remember him offering me pornography magazines at that age and talking about it. And I remember just saying no, knowing that was wrong at 11 to look at Escort and Fiesta.
So did you want... I have to say, yesterday afternoon, I did YouTube an episode of Mud.
Cool.
And it's inimitably you. I mean, it's about that big. But yeah. Looked like the most... I mean, was it, as well as the acting, I suppose it must have just been the most enormous amount of fun that you could have at that age.
Oh, it was incredibly exciting. But you know, the thing that I remember being, like, excited about most was auditioning. I had, like, 6 auditions, loads and loads and loads and loads of boys, and then getting it, and it suddenly felt... I remember my mum coming home from work, and I was at home. She walked in the front door, and she started crying. I was like, what's the matter? She went, you got the job. And she was completely, like, shocked by it. And I was completely shocked that you could actually get something to be on TV. And it was... It felt really simple, because I was just going in having fun in all these auditions. And then actually filming it, we was down in Buckinghamshire for, like, 7 weeks... with a load of adults and loads of other kids, and we'd have like a chaperone, and you do your tutoring during the day, and it was an amazing adventure. And then I was going back to school, and I remember it was quite tough going to senior school, because I'd been there 2 weeks at senior school, and I'd made some friends, and then I got the job, and I was off for like 3 months, and then I came back, and everyone had made their groups of friends, and at that age, everyone's quite cliquey, and I went to school outside the catchment area, so I didn't know anyone anyway. I didn't have anyone to fall back on. I remember feeling really quite lonely in that period of trying to get friends and everything. And then the show come out, and I was in the broom cupboard on the first episode, which I don't know if any of you know the broom cupboard, if you remember it, which was like Toby Anstis. It used to be Ed the Duck and Philip Schofield. It was just like a little room, and it used to be... A presenter used to present like the kids' shows and like say, this is what's coming up. And I was in there after our show, and that was like the biggest thing ever. And then just going to normal senior school in Shenfield and Essex, and everyone found it a bit surreal that I was kind of sat next to them in class. And it was a really weird time. And then I went, in the beginning of the second year, we went to an adventure camp thing, and then I started being a bit cheeky and naughty, and people saw that I was all right. And then as soon as I started being, like, naughty, then they wanted to be my mate. And then after that, it was all right. So being naughty wins.
Okay. So you went to college.
Yeah.
But it didn't
16.
Last.
I did a performing arts course at Barking College in Essex. Everything's in Essex at the minute. And my nan lived 2 doors away from the college, so I got a roast dinner every lunchtime, which was amazing, and jelly and ice cream. I was huge. I put on lots of weight. And I was there for a year, and it was excellent, and everyone was kind of like coming to terms with their sexuality. So I was like with girls 1 minute, and then there were some boys, but it was all secret, and that was all mixed in with the kind of the drama of it all. And I remember I got kicked out because, again, I was cheeky and naughty, and I sort of felt like I knew more than the teachers did. And we had a show, and I was in the chorus of Rent, the musical.
Okay, yeah.
Singing that song. And I got a McDonald's commercial, and I got the Millennium Dome was just opening, and they had a film in the Learning Zone called Lily and the Magic Seed, and I was playing the brother of the girl in it. And I said to them, like, I can't do the... be in the chorus of Rent because I got these jobs. And they were like, ring up your agent, tell them thank you very much, but you've got this show at college. And I was like, I'm not going to do that because I really want to do these. And then they sort of gave me an ultimatum, and I remember the singing teacher saying to me, you won't work ever again if you don't complete this course. And I remember thinking, I'm going to fucking show you. And then I didn't get invited back, and they sort of chucked me off. And then about 3 years later, my friend's cousin was there, and they've got like a hall of fame, and Marianne Jean-Baptiste went there, and suddenly I'm in this hall of fame. And they were like, oh yes, Russell Tovey went to Barking College. And I'm like, they kicked me out. Like, you can't start saying that I'm a former student. You told me to get out and said I'd never work again. But that showed them. Yeah, And then I just kept going from there. I was 17 then, and then I went to Artist Theatre School, which is a drama club run by Amanda Redman in Ealing. And I used to drive all the way from Essex to Ealing Broadway every Saturday and do like 4 hours of everything with them. And again, they had an end-of-year show I was in, and I got a play at Chichester. So this is when I was 18. Got a play at Chichester, and I wanted to do the end-of-year show at ATS. I was so committed to it. My agent was like, you've got to do the play at Chichester. You can't take an amateur dramatic show with friends and training over a professional job. So then there was loads of tears and everything, and then I did the play at Chichester, and that for me was probably the start of everything properly feeling like, oh, this is what it's about and this is who I want to be. Because I was always obsessed with reading plays, and I had that summer at Chichester 3 months, and I boarded with an actor called Kevin Bishop, who you might know is like a comedian actor. Yeah. And we stayed in a house that Sam Mendes had stayed in the year before, so we really went for it. And we had a great time and doing loads and loads of like rehearsed readings and workshops at the Minerva. And there was an actress in it called Deborah Gillette, and her husband is Patrick Marber. And I was reading Closer at the time. And I think Closer as a play is the best play I've ever read in my life. And I met him, and I was slightly starstruck, and he was there with Sam Mendes one night, hanging out in the bar. And then he wrote a play at the National when I was 19, and he got me in it, and he directed it, called Howard Katz, which critically didn't do very well, so he doesn't really talk about it that much. I do. And I did that with Ron Cook, and my agent now was Ron Cook's agent, and I was with a kid's agent with an adult side before that. And then I met this agent, formerly ICM, is now independent, and I've been with her since. And that, for me, was like a moment. And I nearly didn't do the play at Chichester because of like my commitments or something else. But that was like the catalyst for me, and feeling like I want to be a theatre actor. That's what I want to be.
So there wasn't a formal training. It just sort of happened, and those opportunities. But you were involved in stage schools and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Because recently you've been misquoted.
Yeah. I went Silver Young's on Saturdays.
Yeah.
My dad wouldn't let me go there full time because he was worried that I just wouldn't get an education.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And I feel like my school gave me whatever I've got now, my kind of personality, I suppose, because... What the thing that my mum taught me, because being an actor and being on TV and then being at a normal school, my mum was like, never, ever, ever talk about what you do. If someone asks you questions, then answer them, but don't ever be a show-off, because no one likes a show-off. And so that sort of stuck with me. And maybe if I'd gone stage school, I'd have been more show-off, but I didn't, and that's something that, looking back, I'm proud of. But I went to Saturday clubs. I would be like, you'd have like Shakespeare workshops in the woods. I used to go, I'm always like even now, I do improv shows. There's this like woman called Deborah Francis Wright who runs these improv groups, and she's amazing. And I go and do improv shows, and I shit myself every time, and they're like challenged because you don't know what it is. But I love that feeling of putting yourself, like today, this is like bizarre to be all like listening to what I've got to say. But you put yourself in like a position that challenges you, and that's what being an actor is all about. And I've always, always done that and still wanted to learn more.
And it's also defining your own route, isn't it? Because there's a lot of people, I think, who... it's very difficult to make that leap from the world you're in at that age. I mean, I know it was for me in Yorkshire, far away, to how do I become part of that world? Mm. But you, through great good fortune, it had happened already when you were younger. So
But the thing about that is that most... I'd say 98% of the kids that I work with as a kid are not acting now. So I was always aware at that age, thinking I need to make a transition if I want to be a serious actor from a kid to an adult. And because I went through that kind of lanky phase and then terrible skin and big fluffy hair, and I had to grow into my ears and everything took its time, I was always thinking that's what I need to do. And I felt like I was able to make that transition through theatre. That for me was the ability to learn and grow and meet people and better myself. And I did that through theatre. And I think when I got back at the National, I went back there. So I did Howard Katz, and then I did Henry V with Nicholas Hytner when he first took over. And I lapped that over with His Girl Friday that Zoe Wanamaker mm-hmm. and Alex Jennings were in. And then being there, I got a role of Roger in His Dark Materials, which was an epic piece. And during His Dark Materials, they had a reading at the National Studio for the History Boys, and we was all invited to go down there. And the reading lasted about 4.5 hours, and it was so boring. I didn't have a clue what was going on or who anybody was, but we were all there. And then I wanted to play the role of Dakin, which Dominic Cooper played, because I aspired to be the romantic lead. And at that time, there was nothing romantic about me. At all. No one would have wanted to touch me, I felt like. And then I got the role of Rudge. But I remember feeling, and I'd been there a year and a half, and during that time, I had fallen in love with someone who wasn't available. I don't now, thank God, and I'm always paranoid it's going to come back, but I suffered, like, terribly with my skin from about the age of 17 till about, I'd say, 25. And it's a lot worse in your head, but I, being an actor, and you sit in front of them mirrors that have them big strip lights, and they're literally like painting on makeup on my spots. And there's an episode of Poirot I did when I was 17, and they backlit me, and I can't watch it now because I can just see all these little bumps all over my face where they painted them on. And I got the History Boys, and my skin was so shit, I felt like, that I said to my agent, I don't want to do it, I've got to leave the theatre, I need to go and do something else, because we'd been working, I'd been there a year and a half already, and I was kind of like ambitious and wanted to get out. And I was like, I'm not going to do it. She's like, you're doing this play. I was like, am I? She went, you're doing this play. I was like, okay, I'll do this play. But the characterisations, like Rudge, if I'd have been more confident in myself, Rudge might have been more outgoing, but I played this character, like, turned in just a bit like, nobody look at me, I don't give a shit, because part of my personality went into Rudge like that, and that's what defined him in the end, and that was where I found him from, and it came from a total place of insecurity in myself going into that character and playing that, and then Rudge just became like, whatever. And I had the easiest job out of all the boys when we got to show 620 on Broadway, because they're all like that, and I can just sit there and yawn and scratch myself, and literally I could probably fall asleep if I didn't have a line in the scene, because that's the character choice and it wasn't me, so I was able to get away with that. But so that was my kind of, definitely my stage school was theatre.
So it takes the place of drama school, because from where you are at the beginning of the History Boys to where you are, what was it, 3 years of your life?
About 2 years, yeah.
That's a very different place. And, of course, a lot of you, Sam Barnett, Dominic Cooper, James Corden.
Yeah, but we'd all worked before that. Every single one of us worked before that. James was a kid actor as well. And that was a show that opened the doors. It felt like, you see, when you see actors' names attached to projects, they always have a bracket after them that show you what you would recognise them from. So, and I never had a bracket. And that was the bracket. And that's kind of still there. You know, and you're able to go Russell Tovey, History Boys, because it was the play that was a phenomenon, and the film, which wasn't a phenomenon, but did well. And like the radio play. So it kind of crossed a lot of mediums. So that was all of our brackets. And that felt like we came back with a bang from Broadway. We flew back first class from Broadway. They had the last show. We flew to Odeon Leicester Square. They put us up at the Dorchester. We had all these suites. I stole a dressing gown. And and then we met Prince Charles and Camilla. It was a royal premiere. Then we had a party afterwards at Floridita on Wardour Street. And there was like paparazzi there. And I thought, this is great. Then nothing. Then nothing. And James Corden had had Gavin and Stacey greenlit when we was on Broadway, and he said, do you want to come and do a little part in my little show? I was like, yeah, all right. So I went to Cardiff and did that for a bit, and then we had the BAFTAs, film BAFTAs come up, and the History Boys didn't get anything, but Frances de la Tour got nominated for Best Actress, She didn't want to go, so she rang me out. She's like, darling, drop my ticket. I said, yeah, okay, I'll go. And I asked James to come with me. And I went to the awards, and I was there with Dominic, James, and me. And at that time, Dominic was like the golden boy, and Harvey Weinstein was like taking him off, introducing him to everyone. James is incredibly adept, as you know, at socializing. And I was there, and literally people were like, oh, so what are you doing now? And I'd be like, I don't know, I did a bit of Gavin Stacey, and I might try a bit of writing. And they would literally just turn away. And I'd be like, Sienna Miller was there. And Sienna Miller would not stop looking at me. And I was like, this is bizarre, I don't know what she's expecting. And there was one time, there was a moment, and I was stood there with James, and I'd done a show called Tintin. I would play Tintin. And that had done previously. Rufus Norris had directed at the Barbican, and that had just finished recently to that. And I stood there, and there was Jamie Bell and Andy Serkis and me, and I'd done a workshop with Andy Serkis, and this was before, well, it's probably Lord of the Rings time, but he was still around. And Sienna Miller come through the middle of them two, and she looked at me, she went, I'm sorry, I just want to say, I saw your last night and I think you're brilliant. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Thank you, Sienna. Oh my God, it was so nice to meet you. And I sort of like, oh, that's really nice. She saw my last night. And James went, no, she said she saw you last night. She thinks you're another actor who's called Stephen White, who looks very similar to me, who was in a show called Don Juan at the Donmar Warehouse with Reese Iffens. And I remember, and James was like, smug. And I'm thinking, oh, I fucking hate you. And then I left there, and I swore to myself that I will never, ever, ever, ever go to an awards ceremony unless I'm in something that's been nominated or you're presenting, because I felt so shit about myself. And we'd been on such a high, and we'd been promised so much. Sam Anderson said to me that he was expecting, like, we'd be like boy band, we'd just be packed everywhere we go, the History Boys, we're the History Boys tonight. Nobody cared when we got back. We're old news.
But you don't have a function, do you? That's the way. My partner has to go to the Olivier's every year.
Yeah.
And last year I went with him and did my dutiful thing. And I just seethed all evening that I didn't have a role.
You did. That's what I think. If you're there, if you're able to talk about a project you're in,
yeah,
it's great. You feel great. You're celebrating yourself. But yeah. if you can't celebrate yourself, you don't want to celebrate other people. No.
No. Good.
No.
You're doing bits of telly at this stage.
Yeah.
How is it then a lot of young actors who trained say that still when they step onto a film set or a TV set, they feel lost, because our training in Britain is still remarkably stage-based. You haven't had any training, but you have got this backup of being this little boy learning a great deal. So stepping onto a TV set, do you feel at home? Does it click for you?
Yeah, I love... You'll probably find me just sat in the makeup truck chatting to the girls about Dermalogica or something. I love a makeup truck. I love the costume girls. I don't know, I do feel at home, and I sort of know the routine. There is a total routine. You get in, someone directs you to your trailer, then you go into makeup, then you get into costume, then you have a rehearsal, then you have a little break, then you might have a chat with another actor or mess around. And that is like your world. That's what you sort of get used to. I never take it for granted, and I feel very happy on a set. But I do feel like I'm the luckiest guy that that's my job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you became sort of... the king of BBC Three, didn't you?
I did a bit, yeah.
With Being Human, and my favourite, which is, we don't see you, but you do the voiceover for Son, Sex and Suspicious Parents.
I do, yeah.
It's a bit like, I like that, it's a bit like watching, you know, sort of...
Tragic stories. Well, I don't know if you know that, Son, Sex, Suspicious Parents is a documentary about when kids... 18 go on their rites of passage, first holiday with their friends, and they go to like Tenerife, for example, and they've got a camera crew following them around, and unbeknownst to them, their parents are there as well, watching their every move. That's the buzz line. And and then at the end, the parents come out and they're like, surprise, I saw you doing shots of sick or getting fingered by the barman in an alleyway. Or, and then they're like, oh, mum. And then they have a moment. And
I hope we're going to tweet that, getting fingered by the barman. I think that's a rather good...
Yeah, getting fingered by the barman.
How would you have felt if that had happened to you then? If you
got getting fingered by a barman?
No. If you'd gone on holiday and your parents had turned up.
Now I've sort of got to point the show, I feel like I've found the hole, because I'm a bit like, they're going to see it anyway at some point.
Yeah.
The way you're acting in front of this camera isn't like you don't know it's there. So when it comes on TV, they're going to see it. It's just like instantly at the end of the week. But how would I feel if my parents... I don't know. Well, it all depends. It depends how you behave. I'm quite well behaved. I'm not like barbaric, like Brit abroad.
You're just naughty.
Yeah, just cheeky.
Cheeky.
It's a word I like to use. Yes.
Cheeky.
Cheeky and trying to be charming.
Doctor Who, Christmas special.
Yeah.
With Kylie.
Do you know what? Okay, I'm going to show you a link now how TV has worked out for me. So, Gavin and Stacey did a bit part in that, Budgie. I work with Rob, completely blanked his name from the trip. Bryden. Work with Rob Bryden. Rob Bryden did a TV show called Annually Retentive, and he got me in to be his producer in the second series of that, and I did that, and it's improv-y, and it's really fun to do that with him. Russell T. Davies saw Annually Retentive and wrote the part of Midshipman Frame in the Christmas Titanic special with me in mind. I still auditioned for it, and I didn't find out till I got it that he had me in mind, and I was like, could you not just offer it to me? And they're like, no. They have to put you through the pain to make sure you can earn it. And then... So I did that, and the producer of that was Welsh producer, female, with Russell T. Davies, and her name has completely escaped me. Do you know? Does anyone know? No. Julia. Yeah. So she was producer. Oh, it's really bad. You can't quote me on that. You might have to just fill the gap in transcribe
okay.
it. So she was producer of Being Human. So she got me in to Being Human. And then Being Human happened, the pilot, and then that got picked up for a series, and then I kept doing series and series of that. And off the back of Being Human, got me the pilot of Him and Her, which you appear in, the last series. The last two series, wonderfully, legend. And that Him and Her, and then that Him and Her got me the job lot, because that was Big Talk Productions, they were the same production house. So that link... is absolutely, you know, and Gavin and Stacey again was something that was a phenomenon. That was totally unexpected for James, mm-hmm. for everyone, because with the first series we filmed it and we were like, yeah, this is kind of good. And then the second series came out, then it just went stratospheric. And I go back to Essex now and people are like, hey, Budgie, all right, mate, you're a legend. And I'm like, I had like three lines. I'm so like shocked. But the reason Gavin and Stacey, and this is what I'm quite proud of, is set in Billericay. Gavin's from Billericay, because I'm from Billericay and I banged on about Billericay all the time. James and Ruth have never even been to Billericay, and they wrote that because I was there, and he used to ring me up and I'd be like, hey James, we're like, Russell, what's the dialing code for Billericay? It's 01277. How's things? Oh, cool. And then you'd watch the show. You'd watch the show and you'd see Gavin's mum going, 01277. Two like that, and you'd be like, yeah, it's because I told you that. And that's like, so that put Billericay on the map. So when I go back home there, That's like the biggest show. That's it.
Okay. So, this thing about things leading to other things, you've managed to maintain a balance between doing a fair amount of TV and good TV, and some really nice things in the theatre. I mean, you were in The Sea, weren't you, with...
Yeah.
In fact, we had Celia Imrie here last month, who was in that production. Sam Mendes.
Jonathan Kent directed my one, and it had Dame Arlene Atkins in. And that was the one that I did, yeah.
Okay. And was that the National, or was that...
No, Theatre Royal, Drury Lane.
Theatre Royal.
That was great.
Theatre Royal Haymarket.
Haymarket, sorry, yes, we're Theatre Royal Drury Lane now, yes, Haymarket.
And then most recently you did The Pass.
At the Royal Court upstairs. Which was a three-act play about a Premiership footballer who was super famous and was or wasn't gay, but wasn't going to explore it and chose his career, and it ended up corrupting him. And it was told over three acts. And it started off, the show started off with a minute and a half of me skipping in my underwear. And the people seemed to enjoy it. And for that bit. And it did really, really, really well. Really, it was like a big hit. And it was nice, and people were queuing around the block and for like returns. And that's always a nice feeling when you come into work and you can see like them people kind of sat there in the queue waiting to get a ticket.
You have a knack of picking good writing.
Well, I love acting. I love it. It's instinctively to me, I can read something and I feel like I trust myself enough now to know within three pages or like 10 lines of a character that I'm being asked to look at whether I like it or not. And I feel like my instincts have kind of served me well, which is great, and I'm going to keep like following them because I love writing and I love dialogue and I love character. And the roles that I choose, whatever medium it is, I make sure that the character is something that I can completely like get into and understand and find and nuance and enjoy being. And that's always my route in, whatever medium it is, really.
Is there a bottom drawer somewhere at home with scripts in saying, by Russell Tovey?
There's a top drawer. I've got like a writing agent, and I've always written plays. And when I was out filming Banished last year in Australia, it was a strange focus because you're completely on a different time zone, and you'd wake up when everybody's asleep. And I wrote a play there, and then I got a writing agent, and that's kind of doing the rounds now. And it'll either end up somewhere in town, or it'll end up somewhere in Europe in some random village that no one goes to. So I don't know what's going to happen, but and that's something that I find that like improvising on paper, and I find that that's okay. For me, I find that that's like a way of putting everything that I've absorbed through other people's writing and learning my own kind of take on that and seeing what I can do, because I feel like doing it since a kid, I always had scripts, and you feel like you must be able to like by osmosis take that energy of how to write scripts and try and do it yourself. So who knows? That's I love it. Acting's my passion. That's a wonderful sideline, and if something comes of that, be excellent. But I'm not in a garret writing. I just feel like it's something that I want to do as a event.
And you appreciate the work. I mean, there is an example in when we were doing Him and Her, The Wedding, and in episode four, the speeches, you deliver probably what the is worst. One of the most excruciating best man's speeches it's possible to sit through. And yet, because of the writing, it's incredibly familiar to probably everybody who's ever been to a wedding.
Yes.
What I think people might not know is that because of the way we shot that, we did that whole episode in one take, and we did it 56 times on four cameras, but we did the whole episode. I never saw you do that speech live because I left the tent just before you did it. So I first saw it when we saw the episode. It is an absolutely gobsmacking piece of work because at the same time as you weep with laughter at Steve, your stomach feels like it's being hollowed out by a spoon of embarrassment.
Yeah.
Is that technical, or do you just go for it? Do you know what you're doing? Because you did that God knows how many times over 3 days.
You have your instinct. I'll tell you what on Him and Her is that we have an incredible director called Richard Laxton, who's one of the best directors I've ever worked with. Yeah. And he always pushes me beyond where I think I'm placing something. So he always challenges me, and I would literally do a take and I'd be like, nailed that, and he'd come in and go, no, sorry mate, it's really not that, it's more this, and you're like, oh shit, okay, and you start panicking a bit, and then you sort of think, I can't He challenges my instincts. So that speech, I thought at the beginning, take one, was very different to take 54, because it was like, and also the camera's not on me the whole time, so it's like the way Him and Her works is a half-hour show. And what we used to do on a Monday morning, we'd do like a half-hour play for the crew, and they'd follow you around, and you'd do the whole piece, and then you break up to 5 minutes, 6 minutes a day shoot. And that wedding thing, we literally run as a half-hour play over and over and over again to get everybody's reactions, and because there's so many people. And that was a tough week. That was a tough, tough week in the middle of summer in like a marquee, all of us melting. And he crafted that. I would give him responsibility as a director. He definitely got me to there, to where it was. But again, I just try and rely on my instincts. For me, actors, the most exciting actors are instinctive actors. If you can spot a technical actor, you can spot them a mile off. And that to me doesn't, I don't feel anything when I can see the moves. And also when you work with certain actors and you can see if they're instinctive or technical, and I always get excited about the instinctive ones, and they're the ones I gravitate towards. And they're the ones, if you give them something else, they react differently. Sometimes you can give someone 10 different ways of saying it, and if they react the same each time, you're like, okay, cool. Love that.
Are you working with lots of instinctive actors in looking?
Yeah, yes. Looking, well, Jonathan Groff is very instinctive. Most of my stuff is with him. And you can tell, like, an actress, Lauren Weedman, who plays Doris, is incredibly instinctive. And a lot of that show is we'd stick to script, we'd do the script lines, and then we're allowed to, like, mess around and have an improv-y one, and then half script, half improv-y. And that, again, some of the magic they get on screen from the characters is from the relaxed quality and the instincts and the humour that we've all kind of brought to it as well.
So how was it stepping onto an American set for the first time? Because you're very familiar over here, and then you go over to, you know, the whole...
The Holy Grail of America.
The Holy Grail, yes, American television.
My story with Looking was that Andrew Hager had seen me in a play I'd done at the Court, not the past one, called A Miracle, and like a year later, this pilot come up, and I thought, well, I know... He messaged me and said he enjoyed the play, whatever, and I did two tapes here. I did one on an iPhone, which was awful, and they told me off and said, you've got to do it again. So I did another two, and I went to Spotlight, to have actors' studios, so you can go and put yourself on tape, and then they do all that bollocks of zipping it over, which is such a nightmare when you do it at home. The amount of times I've tried to upload something, gone asleep, woke up, and it's like not uploaded, and I'm like, oh my God, so frustrating. It was meant to be there 4 hours previous. But I did them, and then they were like, right, and I was going up for Patrick, which is the role that Jonathan Groff got. But they flew me over to LA, they put me in a hotel, they gave me a car, which I pranged, but they paid for. It was so embarrassing. I remember I went to it, and I got a parking ticket. I had lunch with Andrew Hager. When I got a parking ticket, when we sort that out, took it off me. They must have just thought, get him out of the country. But... And we had a two-day screen test. Now, a screen test, in my mind, as everyone would assume, is that you would be on a screen. They would be filming a scene that you would, which they would then watch back and see what you look like on screen with other characters. No, we were in like a raked stage with seating that went up with all the heads of HBO, all the creatives there, and then we were all kind of wheeled in three at a time, and it was like a rehearsed reading. There was nothing like... I wanted to make Patrick really intimate and small like this. If you had a camera there, you'd pick it up. And I'm like coming in going, oh, hey, Dom, what's up? And they'll be going, hey, Patrick, how are you? Slap on the back. And they'll be going, rah, 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 laughing. And I'll be like, are we doing like a play or a TV thing? And this went on and on. And I really like, I was struggling because I was like, they're coming out with like the worst lines and everybody's pissing themselves laughing. And I'm like, I don't get this. And then Andrew Hager on me that night just went, like, chill out, just go in and enjoy it. I was like, okay. But it just felt weird because everything was angled out and we're sort of looking at each other like that so they can see us, but that's not what you do on TV. Yeah. So the next day, it ended up being me and Jonathan. Jonathan went in with a group, I went in with a group. Jonathan went in, I went in. Then I went home and I thought, Jonathan's got that. I know he's got that. And there was a time difference. And I remember I woke up, no, it was the afternoon and I was having a wee. You don't need to know that. But I was on my phone. I can do two things at once. So I had my phone. I'm going to make it bigger. I had my phone, and uh, uh, I, I was on Twitter and I typed in hashtag looking and it said Jonathan Groff announced as the star of Looking's new pilot, and I found out via Twitter that I hadn't got the role and I was totally gutted because of time difference. But the thing is, when you go up for pilots in the States, you have to sign a contract for how much you're going to get paid, and for the next 5 years they own you. So they don't like own you, but you owe your work to them. Well, if they choose you, you are option to them. And I found out and I was totally, totally gutted, but I was like, I sort of felt that instinct. They said, if it works out, if it gets picked up, we'll write you a part in. I was like, cool. You hear that a lot when people are like, it's not working out for this, but at some point maybe. And then they did. And then they said, oh, there's a role called Kevin. Will you put it on tape in an American accent? And I said, yeah. I said, is there other people going up for it? And they were like, maybe. I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. So I went to Spotlight, put it on tape, did like six scenes in America. And then as I was walking out, I went, let's just do an English one, because guarantee they're going to say, we want to hear it in British. So I was like, oh, okay, do British. Hello, Patrick. How are you? Good. Oh, great, Patrick. Thank you, Patrick. Bye. Put it off. Put it down. Next day, they rang up. We love the Brit. We want the Brit. That's what we want. It was like, okay, cool. And then I went over there, and you expect it to be like Hollywood, like you see in the movies. It's exactly the same as doing a TV show here, except everyone's got an American accent, and they have something called craft service. So here you have like a dirty, dusty tea table with a couple of semi-lukewarm urns, and you get a dirty old biscuits and some sugar cubes that have got like tea splattered on them. And you're like, this is the glamour we get. You go over there, they have a whole spread, this beautiful tablecloth laid out in the middle of the park, whatever you want, constant food, constant like delicious things coming round, wonderful. So it's basically an incredible buffet. That's what excited me, a wedding buffet. And that's the only difference I found. HBO wasn't, because we were filming in San Francisco, we weren't in LA, there wasn't like any industry around us, you didn't feel any pressure of that. And Looking is like a tiny little, we're like a little family, definitely. Nobody lives in San Francisco, so everyone goes there. They're so proud of the show, proud of the city, and it's like a little wonderful kind of world that we're all in there.
And it's great. And it's just a little bit racy.
It is a bit racy, yeah.
We like racy.
Cheeky. Cheeky and racy.
Okay, yeah. I think it's time to go to our roving mic. I don't know who's roving today. Harry's roving with it. And to see what questions we have from our audience. This is the moment. We can get an embarrassing pause when we go any questions, or we can see a whole sea of hands going up. So, right down at the front, which, of course, is good for you, but means Harry has to run.
Oh, hang on.
Oh, there you go.
Hi there. Have your parents seen Looking?
Yeah.
They have. Was that embarrassing for you?
My dad got up to episode four of the first series, five of the first series, and he said, I love you, son. You're very good. It's not for me. I was like, okay, cool. I respected that. Whereas my mum watched it all, but didn't... She watched it all through kind of like, oh, God. And the last episode, the first season, I don't know if you've seen it, but... you've seen it. So I'll spoil it for you, but I end up bumming Jonathan Groff on my office floor. And I said to my mum, I said, look, don't watch the last episode. She went, well, why is that then? I said, because I end up bumming someone on an office floor. And she went, you didn't actually bum him though, did you? So, no, it's not porn. It's acting. So I didn't know she watched it. She came out to San Francisco while I was filming, and someone asked her, and I said, did you actually watch the last episode of Looking? She went, yes, I saw your little bum going up and down. And I was like, oh, God. And anyway, and then in season two, you might not have seen it, I get bummed, not on an office floor, in a bed this time, so it's a bit more romantic. And I said to my mum again, and they haven't got Sky at home, so she's like, Harry and Brenda next door are recording it for us. So when we come back from Tenerife, I'm like, oh, God. So I said, look, I don't think Harry and Brenda are going to be able to cope well with episode three. And I said, and you neither. And she went, I watched it. And then she rang me up. She went, was that real sweat or was that your own sweat? I was like, I said, they sprayed it on. She went, I thought they had sprayed it on. Yeah, very nice, very good. I was like... I thought, yeah, she's great, but I thought, God, that's the final frontier, your mum seeing you get fucked up the arse on TV, isn't it?
Next question. Any more questions? There we go, over the side. Thank you, Harry.
Hi, I'm trained to be an actress, and I get told a lot that I don't have enough confidence on stage, especially if it's like a speech and you're just there on your own. I was just wondering if you've ever had that or had any kind of strategies to...
For confidence on stage?
Yeah.
I think if you're loud, that even if you're not confident, if you're loud, that covers up a lot. If you're quiet, then you shouldn't be on stage. You've got to, people have got to hear you. I think you always get nervous. Nerves are a good thing. Some people say that nerves is vanity, but nerves is wanting to give your best. That's what I put nerves down to. Like, and that pushes you through. If you love what you're doing, then that should give you confidence enough. But also, yeah, you need... I mean, it's tough to get... to feel confident if you've not done a lot of work. I'm not saying you have or you haven't, I don't know, but...
I haven't, no.
Right, well, it's hard probably to have confidence when you don't know your full strengths and abilities and what you can do. And you're only going to gain confidence through, you know, through doing more of what you can do. But yeah, you just got to be heard. I remember I did Howard Katz and Patrick Marble was worried because that was my like second play. And they were worried because I was like mumbling because I thought that's how you act. I assume that if you on screen you can just like talk like this and that's absolutely fine. They'll pick it up. But on stage that's not going to thingy. But I sort of didn't understand. And then to transfer that but then project it out felt at the time so alien because it felt so forced. But that's a total, theatre is a total skill that you don't get through, you don't learn that through TV. It's completely like a whole new skill of, and also they say that, Patsy Rodenberg says, in theatre you take your thoughts from the sky and on TV you take your thoughts from the floor. Because you can on TV like that, but in the stage you can't really do that. You've got to do that because you're taking everyone in. And it's to project, and your performance and character has to also encompass the skill of being a theatre actor is something you learn over time. Now, it's not natural to be on the stage as an actor.
No.
It's natural to have a conversation when there's a camera and you can sort of forget about the camera, but you can't. There isn't an instinct of anybody to be on stage and be like, hello. You don't really... That comes from someone going, this is how you do it.
And we create very naturalistic, very believable behaviour in very artificial situations.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
Okay. We're staying down the front. Look, the whole of the front row.
Love it. Hi.
Hi. You hear a lot these days about public school actors getting all the roles and...
Yeah, I went Eton.
Right.
What are you saying?
Have you ever had any encounters with that glass
my
ceiling
enemies.
Sort of?
Encounters with posh like, boys?
No. True. That? No, but say the public school, maybe the actors getting chosen or considered over actors who are not from that strata.
No, I don't think so. I think if the role's right, you're going to get it. I mean, if it's for a very privileged character, then the casting bracket would probably be cast around actors that have that sound to themselves, I'm sure. But other actors can do that, of course. But I don't feel like they're being prioritised, or I think we're all in it together. And I think I used to... There's a weird thing that when other people are successful, so I don't know whose quotes it, when other people's success, a part of you dies. Or there's something about thinking, oh, fuck, well, they've got that. Well, then they're going to get that and that and that, and I'm not going to get that and that and that. But there's not an infinite amount of success. There's so much success for so many people and opportunities to have a career so many ways. And if you compare and despair, then you're screwed. And I think probably about 6 years ago, I realised that, and I thought, well, that's not healthy. That's not going to help anything. you got better to put out love and support your friends and love them unless they're shit. If they're good, then great. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. And I hope to work with them one day. And you kind of keep going. So I think it's easier if you've worked with them. Or I like Benedict Cumberbatch. I've worked with. You're probably talking about him. He's probably the posh boy that's doing incredibly well at the minute. And he's like the nicest guy. And I've worked with him a couple of times prior to Sherlock. Yeah. And socially, I know him, and he's great.
Well, Julia Crampsey, who's the head of casting at the BBC, who's actually just joined the board of the Actors' Centre, said last week that there's a shortage of working-class actors because it's people can't afford to train at drama schools, which may well be true, and that does need remedying. But Chris Bryant, MP, needs to recognise that Eddie Redmayne and Benedict Cumberbatch are both superb actors.
Is that where he came from him?
Well, he said he started the debate going by, why are we supporting these people when we should be looking for working class actors? Mm-hmm. Actually, they're very good actors, wherever they come from.
Amazing.
They were both nominated for Oscars for amazing performances.
Yeah.
We should celebrate that. It's something we do brilliantly in Britain. We still do it world class. We get nominated for Oscars every year. And instead of belittling those people, we should support them and use that to fund getting more funding for people who can't afford to go to drama schools to be able to go. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to go now. And in the 70s, when I went to drama school, my education authority paid for it in Yorkshire because you used to get grants.
I get asked a lot by people, how do I get into business? How do I become an actor? And if I was starting now, I would go drama school, but if I couldn't afford to go drama school, how would I get in? How would I get an agent? How would I get access? I've no idea. It feels like if you haven't had any prior experience, or you've not got in through the back door, or you know someone, the drama school process is great because it's education itself, but it's just access to an agent at the end.
Absolutely.
And if you go through it all and you don't get an agent at the end, that's a terrifying experience because you're in debt. And you're not able to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
And that's scary. But I'm so grateful that I was able to do it the way I've done it. But I'd say you've got to go drama school to get into it if you've,
Yeah.
And it's so hard.
That's right for you. Very good. Can we go near the back, Harry? Sorry to run you about. We'll come back to you. But there's a hand raised there. You're approaching it. We'll come to you in a moment as well, sir.
I guess first of all is just thank you. I think it's just really refreshing to see a gay actor play a gay role in such an authentic way, and to have a character in the relationship situation that you have with your co-star is I think for an up-and-coming gay audience to see those themes presented so authentically is really refreshing and outside of cliche. I guess the question is, growing up for you, were there openly gay actors or were there gay characters in films and plays that you felt a particular association with or that in any way shaped, I guess, A, your sense of your understanding of yourself and B, how you then went about acting yourself, I suppose?
No, I remember growing up and feeling slightly terrified of being, I didn't feel terrified of being gay, but I didn't feel like I saw anybody that I related to at all in the industry that I could go, oh, cool, oh, yeah, they're a good thing. But I think I was really lucky. I remember being 11 and I had a crush on, I've never talked about this. I had a crush on one of the other actors, not Russell Brand, in Mud. And it crushed me in all sense of the word. I didn't know what the fuck was going on at 11. And there was an actress in it called Susie Blake, who is wonderful. And we were filming and she took me away from the set and she took me down to the beach and she had a conversation with me about it. And she said to me, you know, you might be gay. And this is when I was 11. And I remember feeling like, I don't know what that means. And she said, well, you know, if you are, it's great. And if you're not, it's great. But looking back, she knew before I knew. And I felt completely fine with being gay. That, in that moment, I thought, oh, she says, right. And I loved her. I adored her. And So that, so within myself and within the business that it felt like I was in, I felt completely safe, like it was okay. But I don't, I didn't at the time see anybody in art that, you know, was out that made me go, oh yeah, that's who I want to be like them. At that time, there wasn't. Whereas I feel nowadays, if you're young and gay and you're looking, it feels like a different time, especially in this country anyway, because like I've got friends and their young cousins have after school gay club where they all sit around and talk about who they fancy most in Blue or One Direction, and it's completely acceptable. But we didn't have that. I didn't have that at all. So I think nowadays there are so many actors or performers or singers who are completely out from the start of their careers, and that's an incredible time right now. Yeah. And I think growing up and being gay, you have got so many role models, whether it be like Zachary Quinto or with like Hollywood out, or whether you have like Sam Smith, Grammy Award winner, singer out. You know, you've always, like Elton John's been amazing, Ian McKellen, but they've been of a generation that have done all the hard work and got there, but they've done all the amazing hard work that's allowed us to suddenly go, oh yeah, I'm gay, by the way. And you've never, that's never happened before, you know? And now it's, so that's, I think that's an incredible time that we're in for that.
And you've done quite a bit of that yourself, haven't you? Because you're a brilliant role model for people and for young people now who might aspire to be Russell Tovey.
I suppose so, yeah. There was a moment in San Francisco, so I took my mum out to San Francisco. This is like a 3-minute anecdote, I'll speed it up. So my mum wanted to come to San Francisco to visit, and she went, I want to come when that pervert fair's on. Now, the pervert fair is Folsom Street Fair, which is like a leather fetish fair that happens in San Francisco. My mum wanted to come, and I was like, okay, I'll book you a ticket. So I flew her over, and she got there, and we went to Folsom Street Fair, and the first thing we saw was a female-to-male transsexual, completely naked, walking towards us. So it was a little Mexican man, beard, hairy chest, vagina. The clitoris was the head of a penis. And my mum was like, okay, what was that? I was like, well, that was a female-to-male transsexual. And she's like, okay, good. Oh, look, he's masturbating over there. Should I get a picture with him? I was like, no, leave him. So we carried on walking through, and she was having pictures. I've got with guy dogs, like these men in with leads. She's got them on leads, and she's with some woman who's pretending to be a horse, and someone. And then we got to the end, and she was like, "I've not seen anyone with saline testicles. I really wanted to see them when they have that." They have the, and then we said, "There you go." She went, "Oh, right, get a camera out." She stood there between this guy who had this massive penis with these saline testicles and another one, and she was like looking at it going, does that not hurt? All right, let's do a picture then, like that, posing with them. So we went, and then we hung out in San Francisco, and we hung out with a local drag queen and went to a drag ball, and then we hung out, then there was a screening of Pride, the movie, which I've got a little cameo in, and there's an actor in it who's played by Dominic West, and in real life he was the second man to ever be diagnosed with HIV in the UK, and he should be dead, and he's still alive, and no one knows why. And my mum, I don't think, has ever knowingly met anybody who's HIV positive, and she was sat there with him, and she was cuddling him, and she had a picture with him, and I made her watch that night, We Were There, which is a documentary in San Francisco about when the AIDS epidemic kicked in, and like 15,000 people died within like a year and a half. And we were both crying, and my mum was like, if I was there, I'd have gone in, I'd have washed them, I'd have cooked for them. And she felt very proud. And then we was walking over Golden Gate Bridge the next day, and this kid, who must have been about 17, cycled past his family, and he was from Uruguay, and he went, hey, can I get a picture with you? I love Sherlock. I said, yeah, cool. So he did a picture. He cycled off. 10 minutes later, he cycled back, and he went, hey, I just want to tell you that because of you, in looking, I know who I am now, because you inspired me, and thank you so much for that. My family don't know, so I had to cycle back from my family to tell you, but I wanted you to know. And my mum was like, your parents don't know, you're gay, your family don't know. He went, no. She went, oh, come here, you. Gave him a cuddle. He cycled off. She was crying her eyes out. She went, that's because of you, that is. She went, you said when you were growing up there wasn't anybody, and because of you, he knows who he is now. And I was like, cool. And she left San Francisco really like right on. Like, it's completely fine. And that was, yeah, it was amazing. Clap my mum. It was amazing. I got like, I feel a bit I feel a bit emotional telling that story, but it was, yeah, because before she was never like, oh, they're all freaks. She was just like, she just found it odd, you know, a bar full of men. She was like, oh, it's fine, but I find it weird there's a bar full of men. And now she's like, especially being going to Folsom, being gay is the most normal thing, because seeing what she saw there, the vision she saw, she was like, it's been amazing.
We all want to meet your mum now.
Oh, well, you've met my mum, haven't you?
I think so, yeah.
No, she's a wonderful woman. Yeah, she's incredible.
She is, and I think she passed some of that to you, because I have to say, it's very difficult sometimes when you join a series quite late on, or you go in to do a day on something, and I joined for episode 6 of series 3 of Him and Her. It was a Sunday morning, 7:30 in the morning in a warehouse near Heathrow where we were going to put the whole episode together in an hour and a half. And you made a very special effort to just come over to me as I was queuing at the very crappy breakfast.
Yeah.
Obviously English breakfast table. And made me instantly feel part of a company that you'd worked in for 3 years. And it's a great gift that you have.
Oh, thanks.
And that you also put into being a role model for people to aspire to, I think is fantastic. And I'm thrilled that I can say, would you please thank my very good friend, Russell Tovey?
Thank you.